Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Heather Henderson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and thanks to Cause Chambers Westgarth. I think this is the first function they've had in their new great building here in Sydney, so we're very grateful to be able to use this facility tonight. Heather Henderson was born in Melbourne and moved to Canberra in 1951 after her father, Robert Menzies, became Prime Minister. In 1955, she married Peter Henderson, who's here today, whose work as a Foreign Service officer took their family to post in Jakarta, Geneva, London and Manila before Peter became Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade from 1979 to 1984. The Hendersons have four daughters, 11 grandchildren, and three great-grandchildren, and they live in Canberra. And Heather is here on the occasion of the publication of her latest book, her second book, A Smile for My Parents, by the daughter of Dame Paddy and Sir Robert Menzies. And the talk, the title of the talk for tonight we've given is Remembering Sir Robert and Dame Paddy Menzies. Heather Henderson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, it's really very strange to be here as myself, because I've been an appendage for most of my life. With my father, the Prime Minister, I went round with him, I did all sorts of things, but I was just an appendage. And then a husband in the Foreign Service, and I was just his wife. And now, yippee, thanks to Anne, I am an author. I think it's fabulous to think of being an author. And especially when Anne put out something saying her latest book. Hang on to that one. It's great. But the first book I brought out was Letters to My Daughter, which were letters that my father wrote to me. And it was a really unexpected bonus to hear from people after that and hear what they thought. But with this present book, an old, an ex-public servant rang and he said, I love the book, especially the chapter about the public service. And everybody picks out something different that interests them. And the latest thing is a review, which ends up about the book, if you buy it, and you must, just don't plan to be up early the next morning. Now, that's the best thing I could possibly hear. I was thrilled with that. But after the last book, there was a message in from someone about the wedding of Jeff Bate and Zara Holt. And I'll read you part of it, because he says, SmithKline Animal Health released treatment for calf scars in 1966 with the slogan, Relieve Calf Scars in Hours, with full media coverage for this ambitious claim. Our Victorian manager reported he got an urgent call from the chief veterinary officer to deliver a box of Neftin tablets to an address in South Yarra urgently, as Jeff Bate had given a calf to Zara, and it was, had violent diarrhea, I'll change those words, all over the place. The wedding could be off. Well, blow me down, R.G. recounts the episode on page 203 of the book. So that was a real bonus to get that little addition to the book. Another one was from a man called John Hamilton. And his little bit of news was on page 227. the account of an interview I gave a young man named Hamilton for my birthday. I still remember the occasion well, myself petrified at being sent to interview a figure who had the reputation of not suffering fools, particularly fools from the press, gladly, but instead being utterly charmed by your father, who was kindness itself, and gave me a long and happy interview, which was widely used around Australia. Well, of course, I contacted him, and the next bonus I have put in my next book. And I have to read it out. I was much amused to read your enclosure. It reminded me of another story. I began my career as a cadet reporter on the West Australian in 1959. One of my mentors was an Englishman called Frank Harvey, who had worked on the London Daily Telegraph before migrating to Western Australia, and was very good at the craft indeed. He was even reputed to be able to write shorthand on a pad with his hands behind his back. Again, Harvey drew the short straw to interview the PM at Perth Airport and had been told he wouldn't get very far. So Harvey tried another approach. He wrote a short letter, which he managed to hand to one of the PM's staff on arrival. Harvey told us cadets that it went along the lines of, "Dear Prime Minister, I'm a recently arrived English journalist working for the West Australian. My Australian colleagues tell me that you do not normally grant interviews to the press. However, I would be immensely glad if we could share a couple of minutes of your time to have a chat about A. cricket, B. tennis, or C. Betty Grable's legs. Yours sincerely, Frank Harvey." The result was that the note was handed to your father, who roared with laughter at this impudence, called Harvey over, and granted him a short interview. I think they may have settled on cricket. Another very nice letter I received was from a man called Mario Peroni, and I have also put this in the book. And part of what he said was, my family were Italian migrants and we came from Egypt, where my father was an accountant in a bank in Alexandria. In the 60s I worked in Tahiti for Qantas. Your father, then retired, was travelling to the USA via Tahiti. His office sent specific instructions that he did not wish to be met in transit. I was the duty officer in the early hours of that morning, and I did exactly what your father had requested anyone not to do. I met him at the foot of the aircraft. He greeted me with, "Young man, you should be in bed." I assured him it was an honour to be there. I took him to a private office and had a long chat with this amazing man, who said to me that the best Italian migrants came from Egypt. I'm sure he was not being political, as he didn't have to say it. An experience I never did forget. But a year or so later, I saw Sir Robert walking down Collins Street. I went to him and said, "Hello, Sir Robert. My name is Mario Peroni. We met at the Papiette Airport." I thought I'd made a real gaffe, but I was wrong. With that wonderful smile of his, he replied, "Of course I remember you. You're the young man from Italian parents that lived in Egypt and was very naughty to meet me in transit." Says something for Dad's memory, doesn't it? Pretty good, even then. The other one I had just the other day was an email from someone who was a pilot in the Air Force, and he flew VIP planes for 34 Squadron. And he had a story about when he was a co-pilot, and the planes were small in those days, and they were coming in to land somewhere. turbulence was awful. They were all over the place, bumping around, and it took the entire runway to stop. And with the reverse thrust, is what you call it, of the engines, the noise and the shuddering was dreadful. They turned around, they came, pulled up in the end, and my father got out, went into the cockpit and said, "A safe landing, pilot, in spite of your efforts." Another bit about planes. My parents travelled a lot, of course, and once they were coming back from overseas and they were got into the plane in America and were flying across America, and a young couple got in with a baby, and the baby was crying, if not screaming, and apparently had been crying for the last leg of the trip, and the parents were exhausted. So there they were on the plane with this crying child. So once they'd taken off, my mother went over and said, "Give the child to me." I can just hear her saying, "Give the child to me." So she got it. She walked up and down the plane with this screaming child, patting it on the back, until the baby stopped crying. She then sat down with the wet bundle, as she called it, on her knee, and she said, "I was terrified to move in case it woke up." So there she sat for about 2 hours while the parents were sound asleep, and we discovered who the people were because they were in foreign affairs, and I'm clattering everywhere, and we found out who the child was. And the child is now official secretary at Government House, so he's grown up and all is well. But my mother was fanatical about babies. She loved babies and small children. It didn't matter if they were nice or awful. I mean, I'm more discriminating, really, but she loved them all. And she, at the lodge, was always welcoming with children. And only recently I heard about Eddie Ward's wife being invited to a lunch at the lodge with a lot of members of Parliament's wives. And Mrs. Ward said to my mother, "I'm sorry, I can't come because I have a 10-year-old child." And my mother said, "Oh, bring the child, I'll look after her." And she did. And that child is now an adult and remembers this story, remembers her mother talking about it. And they've never forgotten my mother's kindness, of course. And my hairdresser's husband the other day, you might think I haven't got one, but he came in and he said he went to the lodge once with his parents. I'm not sure why. And my mother took his young brother off and walked around the garden with him and looked after him. So she was always happy to look after children. And in the neighbourhood of the lodge, of course, the children could come in and out at will. And indeed, they did. But mentioning Eddie Ward, of course, takes me to Parliament. And Eddie Ward was always asking questions and was very anti-Menzies. But it has to be said for Ward, he's had a good sense of humour. And one day he was sitting there next to Arthur Calwell, and my father was making a speech about somebody who had died. And apparently he did it very well and very nicely. And Eddie turned to Arthur Calwell and said, "When I die, all I want is for Bob to get up and say he was loved by all." Well, Eddie Ward died, and my father got up and made a very generous speech about him. And on the way out of the house, Jim Killen stopped him and said, "How could you say such nice things about Ward when he said such dreadful things about you?" And my father looked at him and said, "Killen, there's something good to be said about every human being in this world. Who knows? the day might come when we can even think of something good to say about you. The other one who in Parliament had a great sense of humour was Jim Cope. He was a Labour member who eventually became the Speaker of the House. And just to give you some idea of it, when my father died, Jim Cope wrote to my mother, and this is part of what he said. "Prior to my entering the Federal Parliament in May 1955, I imagined Mr. Menzies, as he was then, to be a supercilious, arrogant person. However, in a short time, I discovered to the contrary, that Bob, as he was more fondly known to me, possessed a warm and friendly personality, plus a very keen sense of humour. I recall with pride that whenever we met by chance in the lobbies, he always spared a few minutes for a little chat." That's a good thing to hear from somebody from the other side of politics, isn't it? And that was part of the way it was in those days. They could be friends as human beings, but opponents in the House. And everyone noticed this, that they could be in the House, they could argue, they weren't as nasty as they are now, but they could certainly criticise forcefully. But once they walked out, they could be friends. Let's have a drink, whatever it was. And I remember Dad talking about Chifley sitting opposite him across the table and rowdy noises going on around, everyone yelling or interjecting. And Chief or Dad would sort of look at each other and they'd go casually, walk behind the speaker's chair and, "Ben, can't you control your boys?" Or Dad saying the same thing. They would just have a little quiet chat and then go back into the House and sit there looking innocent. They were real friends. And sadly, I'm not sure that that happens now. But Jim Cope, one day, Alan Fraser, the member for Eden Monaro, now known as the Bellwether seat, asked a question, and he asked a question of the Prime Minister, and he said, "You went to the St Andrew's night dinner and you complained that they didn't pronounce your name correctly. It should be Mingies, not Menzies. But do you know what people really call you in this country?" So my father got up and said, "I do indeed." And at that same St Andrew's night dinner, when I arrived, there were people yelling out in stentorian tones, "Pig iron." But often when I'm in my car and I'm stopped, if the truck pulls up next to me, the driver will look across and say, "Oh, good on you, Bob." Jim Cope said, "Should have been pinched for drunken driving." So, of course, Dad loved that so much he beckoned Jim. And after question time, Jim went round to the office and my father gave him a drink. So that's the way it was. The man who was dispensing the drinks was a fellow called Alf Stafford, who used to be the Prime Minister's driver. And then he was not able to drive for medical reasons. So he went to the office and he was, I'm not sure what he was called, but he was always there. And one night, the cabinet and whoever, they'd been up late and they'd had a few drinks. And the next morning when they arrived, Alf Stafford was there and he whipped off the top of a bottle of Pilato, fizzy orange stuff, handed it to Eric Harrison, who was a teetotaler, and said, "Here, Sir Eric, have a hair of the dog that bit you." But I don't know why I even remember that. Ridiculous. And there was one night when my father was working late, as he usually was, and he wanted to say something to his press secretary. So he went over the corridor and opened the door of the press secretary's office, and the press secretary was not there, but his secretary was there typing away. And my father said, "You're working very late." And she said, "Oh, well, that's all right, sorry, but I wanted to get this done." And she said, he said, "Have you had dinner?" And she said, no, I'll get something later." So he disappeared and came back later with a tray of dinner for her. And I thought, see, he wasn't the ogre that some people think. And this was the girl herself who told me that story. But Parliament House, have you got a hanky by any chance?
I've got everything here.
Thank you.
It's clean, by the way.
Thanks. If you talk about Parliament House, we now have a big new Parliament House, not so new. But to me, it's... Thank you. Sorry, I don't want to spoil that. She's got to get it out there. Thank you. The old Parliament House was small and everyone knew each other. And when they were out of the house, they mingled. They didn't have their own offices. They didn't have their own staff who all voted the same way as they did, who thought the same way as they did politically. Everybody was together. And if they wanted something typed up, they went to the typing pool. And they were not surrounded by people with the same political views. And to my mind, that made for much better and happier government, because they knew each other. It's much harder to be nasty to people if you really know them. So I'm much preferred the old Parliament House to the new one. I think the new one is so big. They seem to yell at each other in the house, and when they walk out of the house, they go back to their own little burrows, and they don't know each other. And it makes me very unhappy. But Parliament House, of course, is in Canberra, so I cannot fail to mention Canberra, which my father thought the development of Canberra was one of his real achievements. I know it's hard for people in Sydney to get a grip of this, but it is the capital city. It does matter. And I think that's where government should be. But Canberra, of course, includes the lodge. And my parents were there for a long time, so it was home. It was home to them for, 16 years straight. They had no other home, so that was it. And my mother was a very domesticated person, but at the same time she became adept at doing all the things she felt were the duties of a Prime Minister's wife. And she became very good at making speeches. She went right around Australia speaking to people, not political speeches, but talking about what she'd been doing, what her life was like, whatever it was. And she was very good at it. People really responded to her and enjoyed it. At home, she was always ready to move because they did a lot of travelling. She had a suitcase sitting open, I think, in her bedroom at all times. She had to entertain people. She had to go out and be nice to people, I suppose, but I don't think she found that all that difficult, to be nice to people. And she did domestic things, like in the kitchen. At some stages, she actually did the cooking because there was no cook. And she got an Aga stove. And one Saturday, when she had people for dinner, the Aga went wrong. So she rang the man who had the Aga franchise, who came around, and he said, "I don't really know anything about them." So it ended up with the two of them lying on the floor of the kitchen, peering into the innards of the Aga, trying to make it work. And they got it working, which was very lucky, because they wondered what they would have had otherwise, except scrambled eggs, I suppose. So she was always busy. There was a problem that she had with insects. She was very allergic to insect bites. And there were hornets at the lodge. So she rang the department and said, could you do something about the hornets? But nothing happened. And still nothing happened. But eventually it did. She was bitten by a hornet. And she immediately blew up as if she had mumps. So she tied a scarf round her head and went out and went to the department, went to the appropriate person, took off the scarf and said, and now will you do something about it? So she got it done in the end. Rather different from Tammy Fraser, you know, because by then there was a wall round the lodge and it guards at the gate. And Tammy wanted to go out one day. She was going to the hairdresser. She tied a scarf round her head. She drove to the gate and the guard came over and said, yes? She said, I'm Tammy Fraser and I want to get out. And so he said yes. But it was so different. We were very lucky to have it. And another thing, actually, just while I think of it, Tammy Fraser was at our house one day and she left her sunglasses behind. So I took them back to the lodge. And sure, yes, I was on my bicycle, so I didn't look too flash, I suppose. But when I got to the gate, I said to the guard, I've got some sunglasses that belong to Mrs. Fraser. So he got out his little walkie-talkie, whatever, and said, there is a person here who has an object that she wishes to give to someone in the house. Over. And this idiot conversation went on to for a pair of sunglasses. Oh dear, it's awful, isn't it? I suppose I really ought also to mention the Currawongs, because my father, my mother rather, hated the Currawongs because they attacked the baby birds. And so she kept a Shanghai, one of those things like this, tucked in the wisteria. And my parents used to sit outside and have a drink or a cup of coffee, whatever it was. And every now and then my mother would grab the thing, get up and have a pot shot at the Currawongs. And one day my father said, Pat, for goodness sake, sit down. One day you're going to hit a passing pedestrian and then we'll be in real trouble. And of course it would have been impossible to reach a passing pedestrian. Well, I suppose I could go on for a long time about the lodge, my mother and everything else.
Big questions.
My father said, never stand up until you know how you're going to finish to speak. And he had sat through many meetings and gatherings where the local mayor or the chairman or someone had got up to talk and gone on and on and on because he didn't know how to stop. I have sinned, actually for the first time, I think, and I have not thought of any way to finish. So all I can think is my brother Ian saying, if you make a speech, stand up so you can be seen, speak up so you can be heard, and shut up so you can be appreciated.
Thank you. Many thanks to Heather Henderson. I think we could have wired you. Oh, no, we couldn't have.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine. It was just one of those. No problem at all. Many thanks for that, and for setting up the great puzzle for the night. I still haven't thought of anything nice to say about Jim Killen, but I'm working on it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something nice about
me. I'm working on it. We've got Janet Grundy's got copies of A Smile for My Parents and of Heather's first book, Letters to My Daughter, and I'm sure Heather Henderson will be happy to sign both. And so we come to questions and discussion. We've got till the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. Just come back to where you were. Tell us a bit more about your father, because you're talking there about him as a person, but he's also the man who, when he was Prime Minister the first time around, lost the support of his colleagues and felt the need to step down. So then he comes back and stays as long as he wants to stay and could have stayed longer had he wanted to stay longer. So did he change his personality in the period between 1941 and 1949? Or did he just manufacture a different personality to appeal more to his colleagues?
Does anyone ever change their personality? I don't think so. And certainly there was nothing phony about him. He wouldn't have manufactured something like that. I can't think of him like that at all. But of course, I was a schoolgirl in 39 to 41. I was an adult when he came back in 49. And it's very hard to answer that question because he was just Dad. And I don't see that people's actual personality changes. I think maybe they change the way they handle people. Certainly, I think he became better at handling and getting on with the people who worked with him, for him, all the rest of it. I can't think of any more.
That's fine. That's fine. So, Janet, just hang on. Have a microphone, if you just.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. A little childhood memory. Lady Josky, you know Lady Josky?
Yes, of course.
She had a wonderful story about his brother when he was about 14, and of course we all loved his oratory, and he must have owed it to Shakespeare. But her job as the daughter of the Methodist parsonage was to do the ironing every Saturday, and he would often call in and jump on the large bench thing while she was trying to do the ironing, and recite Shakespeare.
Oh, what?
It's a lovely story, isn't it? And
isn't
sometimes
it?
She'd throw something at him, but particularly with friends, Romans, countrymen, that sort of thing. He used to love to practice his Shakespeare.
Oh, is that marvellous? Well, can I just make another comment about the ironing? It reminds me of someone who got in touch with the publisher, really, about my father, my parents. And I spoke to her two nights ago, and she said her mother used to do the ironing for some friends of my parents. And one night when my parents were going for dinner, she and her sister and her mother were...
Just go on, I don't know what that is. It's not your fault, just go on. Okay.
That was my fault.
Okay.
That's the best interjection I've ever heard.
Okay.
She said they went to help with the dinner when my parents went for dinner, and they had rabbit, which was stuffed. And my father said, "Who sewed up the rabbit?" And she said, "My sister Bernice said I did." And I thought, after all these years, isn't that an extraordinary story to hear?
So there's...
There we are.
Tim, and then sat down there and then come up.
Mrs. Henderson, Tim James, thanks very much for a great account. It's lovely to hear a bit more about the people themselves, their lives and times and circumstances. I wanted to ask you, if I may, about the party that your father founded. And in 1945, he said, "The essence of the party is its democracy. There are no vested interests." Do you think he would agree today? And what do you think his assessment would be of the Liberal Party today? Thank you.
I think that's a bit hard, actually.
Thanks, Jim.
He did die half a century ago, or not quite. He did die four decades ago.
But he did. He was always up to date in his time. And he would have been up to date now. And it's very difficult to say what he would think or agree with or not agree with. And as my mother said once, I wouldn't dream of saying what my husband would think if he was here today. And after all, I knew him pretty well. So I think I can do no better than that.
I was just wondering what Dad, your father, was like at home. for example, did he get grumpy if things didn't go his way politically? I have in mind, for example, the High Court disallowing the communist bill. Must have been, you know, a bit of a setback. Did he?
I don't remember him ever getting grumpy about things at all. He might have become slightly more silent when things didn't go the way he wanted them to. But at home, he didn't really always bring, or hardly ever brought, politics home. I think that was work, and at home, well, sure, he talked about a few things that went on, but I don't remember him ever getting grumpy about things like that. I suppose he did get short-tempered occasionally. Yeah. I don't know. Can't do any better.
Question. Oh, here.
Sorry. Yeah, I was just wondering, you mentioned earlier that you're a seed daughter of the Prime Minister and then the wife of the Foreign Affairs Fellow. There was a lot of room for you. I'm wondering what time you had with your father and your personal memories of his, as his daughter growing up in the Lodge.
Yeah, well, I didn't grow up in the Lodge. I grew up in Melbourne, but I certainly lived in the Lodge for some years, and I had a lot of time with my father, and I travelled with him. I went on election tours sometimes, and we knew each other pretty well. And I spent a lot of time with him, and he was not a remote father at all. He was much more remote when I was young, because when he was a lawyer, he would be working all the time. And in the early days, when he was a Member of Parliament, he would catch the train in Melbourne on Monday night, come back on Friday, and he'd be away the whole week, and then half the time he was working at the weekend. So he was an absentee father for a lot of the time, when I was young and when I was growing up. My mother was really the mother and father. She was both.
That's the plight of a lot of politicians' children. But tell us about your time in Melbourne. When you talk about growing up in Melbourne, that's what, Kew and Bourne, is it?
Well, we lived in Kew.
Just tell us about that.
Well, we lived in Howard Street, Kew, and I went to school at Ryton all my school days. And my brothers went to Trinity Grammar, and then they went to boarding school at Geelong College. And so they were away from home quite a lot of the time when I was still at home. And we had somebody, a Scottish girl called Kathy, who was with us for many years. So she was, in a way, almost my mother, because when my parents were in Canberra, Kathy was always there. And when I went in to be a boarder, when my parents were in Canberra, Kathy would walk up with the dog after school to see me. And so I was by no means abandoned. I was well looked after.
So what age was Kathy in relation to you? How older was she than you?
Probably only 15 years older, something like that.
So she's a young woman. Mm. There's a question there, then we go here and here. Yeah.
Thank you. I wonder, could you shed some light on the period, the time of the formation of the Liberal Party? I've had two first-hand accounts of your father's circumstances. One of them was from my father, another from a person living in Sydney, that when he moved around at that time, he wasn't provided with any transport. It was during the war, it was towards the end of the war, he attended the formation meeting at the Mossman Town Hall, one of the meetings, and one of the stories was that my father drove him to that moment. My father was an engineer in Sydney who had a vehicle and petrol because he tended to Sydney's power stations. And the other story was that your father went to see a remote political friend in Brookvale, and he crossed the harbour on the ferry and then took the bus from Manly Wharf to Brookvale. Mm. And just thinking back, he'd been Prime Minister. Was he leader of the opposition?
Yes, he was leader of the opposition, yes.
Not provided with any sort of transport. Does that sound right?
Yes, it does, because he was doing something political and not to do with his job as leader of the opposition. So, no, he would not have used the official car or anything. And I can quite believe all of that, yes. And there was another thing he did, and I've forgotten the details, but his driver in Canberra, in Melbourne, was somebody called Peter Pearson, who was his government driver. And my father wanted to do something that was not political, not to do with the job. So Peter drove him in somebody else's car. And so that was nothing to do with work. So I think he just did it because he was very fond of my father. But no, that rings true to me. I have got a chapter in the book called Stingy with Public Money. And that would come under that heading if I'd thought of it.
Question here.
Yes, you quoted your father shouting Shakespeare to people, and to some friend, and I just wondered, did he talk about poetry at home, or did he recite poetry, or encourage you to like poetry, I mean, or music, or songs, and so on?
Oh, yes, he did. And when we were younger, he did occasionally recite poetry, which I always found a bit embarrassing, actually, when I was little. But he loved poetry. It was part of his life. And he had a good ear for music, too. His brother was a singer. He was not by profession a singer, but he was a very good singer. And my father was brought up by a father who made them all read out loud. So he was accustomed to reading aloud. And he could read, if it was poetry, he could do that too. He was very, very at ease doing that sort of thing. And it came out in his speeches, because he never made a speech. He never talked without having a quote coming out somewhere. It was always like that.
There's a question here. Well, I think we can pick her up in the microphone, so yes. Peter.
Yeah. Yes, I just wondered what your mother's reaction was when the 12-metre America's Cup Challenger was named Dame Patty, and was that exciting for her? Did it get you interested in yachting at the time?
Oh, I think she was very excited about that. She loved it. And my parents went over to watch it sail at Newport, and she was very proud of it. She was always proud of the ships she'd launched. But that was special because it was named after her.
Heather is one of my oldest and dearest friends, and Peter too. We were at Melbourne University together. We won't say how many years ago. But it's been a joy to have been associated with her all those years. And for so many years, I have been telling her that she should have carried on the work that her father started. If she had, I think we'd have had a very brilliant first woman Prime Minister. And I only wish that she had listened to some advice that we've been giving her for many, many years. She's my daughter's godmother, and it's been the most wonderful relationship, and to see the development that has occurred all through her life, through Peter as well, and I only wish that she had fulfilled what I was trying to get her to do so many years ago. And thank you, Heather, for everything.
Thank you, Bella.
So the question is, should you have contested a by-election for Kew Yong against Andrew Peacock in 1966? That's the question, I think.
And the answer is, it would have been such fun, but I was married to a public servant, and in that case I felt I could not be political. I was very good. I tried very hard for 30 years? 33 years to be apolitical. I think I did very well, except at election time when I got a bit twitty, but not publicly. And I'm very proud of my behaviour, so that's explains it.
Heather, a few of our, I might say, pro-Labour historians have spoken about Robert Menzies and his father as being rather distantly, a distance between them, because he was a very strict father. But in the letters that he wrote to Ken and other bits and pieces in your stories, obviously the Menzies were a very close clan.
Yes, they were.
Could you tell us a little bit more, since you saw this behind the scenes, not just like Judith Britt from a couple of radio speeches. Could you tell us about Bob Menzies and his parents and his siblings and what kind of a family they were?
Yes, they were a very close family. And he was, particularly close to his mother, because I think he was, well, I suppose we all have a bit of both, but his mother had the same sense of humour as he had, and he always loved her sense of humour. Grandpa was not a humorist in any way. He would lay down the law about everything. But I think, I suppose, my father got some of his ability to speak to public meetings and be able to cope with all that sort of thing came from his father. His father was a politician as well, and he was very strong, very forceful. And as I said before, he made the family read out loud. And with Douglas, who was a cousin, when Douglas was there, Douglas had a stammer, and he said, "Don't stammer, boy, don't stammer." And believe it or not, Douglas stopped stammering. But people did what Grandpa said. And he was a bit scary. He was an artist. He used to paint. And when I knew him, he was slightly shaky. And he was seemed to me an old man. Who's talking? But he was not somebody who was cozy at all. But Grandma was. She was much... not quite so. I don't know, she was fairly unbending. I didn't find them really as very warm, but my father did. He was devoted to his parents, and but to his siblings too. And he and, well, Les died when he was fairly young, but Frank, Bill and Sid, they were extraordinarily close, and all for different reasons. They were very different people, but there was a huge bond between them. I think fairly unusual in a family. I don't think that was a very good answer.
I think it's a fine answer. We're getting close to the end now, so if I missed anyone, well, there's another one here. Yeah.
Thank you. Another shedding light on, perhaps an apocryphal story, but when your father was elected to the Victorian Parliament, he was a practising lawyer, and he continued as a barrister at that time.
Yeah.
Now, the story is that he became Attorney General of Victoria, and there was a matter where involving a long-standing client, or the client of a solicitor with a long-standing connection, who was involved with a case against the Crown. So at least when the matter was first listed, Mr. R.G. Menzies was leading the case for both sides as Attorney General and as the leading the defence case.
Now, I think this is probably a bit unlikely, but it's a good story. Was your father both the counsel for the appellant and the defendant? I mean,
was he in practice when he was Attorney General as a barrister?
Sorry, what was that question?
Well, the question is, was your father in practice as an Attorney General when he was a barrister, as a barrister when he was Attorney General? I think the answer to that is...
Don't ask me.
What's that? No, we're talking...
See, everybody knows more than I do. All I can say is, look it up somewhere.
The question is whether he was a barrister in the court when he was the Attorney General, not when he was a politician.
No.
I would doubt it. I would really doubt it. I don't...
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's different. But he was when he was opposition leader, I think, when he was when he was a politician. But I don't think he ever was when he was an Attorney General. I don't think that's the case.
Well, I think it's really not fair, because you can all look it up.
Yeah, we can look it up. We're going to go away and...
You can probably get out your mobile phone and go like this and tell us straight away.
Now, as a final question, why did you decide to write these books? Because when I spoke to you 20 years ago, when I was doing Menzies Child, you vowed and declared that you weren't going to write about... that you couldn't write about your family. And you didn't... I mean, I sort of walked away thinking this wasn't going to happen. And then it happened not once with the letters, but now with this personal account.
Yes.
So why did you do what you decided to do?
Well, the letters were not really my book. That was Dad's book.
Yeah.
It was his writing. I just did bits in between. This is my book, and I don't think I'm a writer really, so I can only write as I talk. And I did it because I was nagged at so much by so many different people. Like...
Again, and myself.
Mm.
Yeah.
She's the one who knows much more.
Okay, many thanks. You're just not too far away because we'll...
I'm tied up. Terribly sorry.
Just leave it there. Just leave it there. Yeah, okay, just so you're tied up. Look, it's been a great night. I am very pleased that Heather Henderson edited her father's letters because they give a personal insight to a man that we knew a lot about, but not much about him personally, because they were different times. The media wasn't as extensive as it is now, and in the letters he comes out as a person which we didn't really know before, so I'm delighted that happened. And I'm also delighted that Heather Henderson went and told her own story in A Smile for My Parents, because she's done a tremendous amount to give a personal account of the person who was Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister and one of the most important figures in Australia's history. So I'm glad you did them both. I'm glad you spoke about both of these books at the Sydney Institute. As I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of both books, which I'm sure Heather Henderson would be delighted to sign. So once again, thanks for tonight. Thanks for making the contribution that you've made with your two books. And I'm delighted that Anne and myself were just two of those who nagged at you and said you should do it. I know there are others, but we're glad we made our contribution. It's nearly 7 o'clock, so thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.